Welcome to Public Health Matters with Dr. Christina M. Madison, the founder and CEO of the Public Health Pharmacist, PLLC, a public health consulting firm. She is passionate about spreading knowledge on public health in order to create healthier and happier communities.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Public Health Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Madison, also known as the Public Health Pharmacist. I'm extremely honored and privileged to have this next amazing guest, Dr. Brenda Cassidy. She is currently a practicing nurse practitioner, working with University of Pittsburgh, doing some amazing things within adolescent health, as well as specifically working with the LGBTQIA+ community. So I'm so excited to bring her on today. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and let Dr. Cassidy introduce herself a little bit more before we dive into some questions.
Sure. Thank you so much, Christina. So I am a pediatric nurse practitioner and have my DNP, Doctor in Nursing Practice, teaching at the University of Pittsburgh, I don't know, off and on for probably over 20 years at the graduate level. And so I'm an associate professor here, and I also am the director of the pediatric and neonatal nurse practitioner programs. In addition to that full-time job, I see patients in two different practice sites here in Pittsburgh. One is the is a private practice. It's just a community neighborhood private practice in the East Liberty area of Pittsburgh, which is an underserved area. And I've been there in that practice. It's just pediatric, so it's newborn through age 22 years. And I've been there for probably 25 years. So it's kind of multi-generational. I watch my kids grow up in that practice, and then they start families either before they're ready or when they're ready and bring their kids to me. So it's really been a wonderful experience to have that kind of a community practice. The other place I practice is the adolescent clinic in on campus in Oakland in Pittsburgh, and I've been there for about 7 years, I think. So when I kind of a little bit about my journey, when I went through the pediatric nurse practitioner program here at Pitt, they had a special track for adolescent health. And we did clinical in the adolescent clinic with the providers that worked there, had an adolescent theory course. And, you know, the adolescent age group is quite different from the preteen and younger kids. And so I felt adequately prepared to treat that age group. And also my nursing background, I've been working with children and teens, I hate to say, 45 years. I said that to someone earlier today. And
wow.
I thought, oh my goodness, for real? For real.
Let's acknowledge that. Let's affirm that. Amazing.
I was talking to a student about when you know you want to work with kids and teens, you know. So, but anyway, yeah. And adolescents, even as a nurse, has really been the age group that I've worked with for most of those 45 years. I've had nursing jobs in psych settings with adolescents. My span of experience is really has been that age group for the most part, although I definitely see newborns through adolescents as well. But when I came back here to teach after practicing for a while, I realized that the adolescent clinical that I had experienced was gone. And I was teaching an adolescent theory course, and I was doing site visits with my students in the community practices, pediatric practices, and kind of, you know, spying on how they deal with teenagers and just feeling like they were not addressing the unique needs that adolescents have in terms of health. And felt very prepared, having had this adolescent experience in my program, that I was able to do that. And it starts with understanding and providing confidential care and understanding the laws, because it's state determined, you know, what you are permitted to do in terms of providing confidential care to the teens. And the very first piece of that is making sure that you're doing interviews with parents out of the room when they come in for their well visits. And so many of these pediatric practices just were not doing that. And I received some funding, internal funding, and created a partnered with the adolescent clinic providers and chief medical officer, Elizabeth Miller, if anyone knows her, she's like a dynamo. But we were able then to create a clinical course. And so now our students, the pediatric nurse practitioner students and family nurse practitioner students here, not only take a 2-credit adolescent theory course, but they also have a 1-credit clinical where I precept them in the adolescent clinic, and they also shadow some of the other providers. And so again, part of that journey was finding when I went to the adolescent clinic that, and that was back in 2014. So in terms of the LGBTQIA plus population, back in 2014, especially with youth, there wasn't really legal support to provide for that age group in that vulnerable community. And so, but I was working with and still work with unbelievable providers in that clinic who were very engaged with the LGBTQIA plus youth, supporting them in any way possible. And Dr. Liz Miller and some of the other providers there developed a gender program, not sure what the name of it is right now, gender development program, I think, but it's basically a clinic that the
the affirmation process. So
yeah, so that.
Brenda, that is amazing, and I really appreciate that as someone else who also practices with a nurse practitioner, and our clinic actually caters to the LGBTQIA plus community. And we do have a lot of youth that come to our clinic. And so, as a pharmacist, I think a lot of times we don't get formal training to, first of all, to deal with adolescents. And second of all, specifically with the youth that may be, part of the sexual and gender minority expansive space. Right. And so as we continue to do better to affirm, this community, I think it really does need to be something that we need to focus on, especially when it comes to providing things like gender affirming care. Because if somebody's coming to your community pharmacy and they're accessing hormones and you're, not using proper pronouns, you're not using preferred name, these are all microaggressions that lead to acute and chronic stress and lead to them not wanting to seek medical attention. Right. So, yeah, so I really appreciate that. With that being said, just wanted you to maybe touch a little bit on sort of this concept around confidential care, because I think that's also another thing that we don't talk as much about, right? Because once you get to a certain age, we can start providing you care without mom and dad in the room. And especially when we start talking about sexual health, when we start talking about offering things like HIV prevention, so like PEP and PrEP, talking about intimate partner violence, sexual assault. These are all things that, maybe someone doesn't want to talk about in front of mom and dad. And then now we're seeing assault on reproductive health with Roe versus Wade being overturned. And right. That now not just impacting women, but also our trans masculine individuals who may need these services. And in particular, if they're on testosterone, that pregnancy is not likely to be viable and would need those kinds of services. So with that, I will let you respond.
Yeah, I mean, excellent points, because, I'm in a position as an educator to address this in school, so that, what I found in the clinic were a couple of things related to what you just mentioned. Number one, students like being worried and afraid, and actually providers are often afraid to ask parents to step out of the room so that they can have a, you know, private conversation. Never, ever have I had an issue with a parent. And a lot of times they just sit in the waiting room, you know, and come in when I call them in. But people are worried and they're unsure about how to say that, how to ask them to leave the room. And then the other piece is the issue of, you know, thank goodness we are paying attention to affirming and asking about pronouns. But what I found was that the students were really unsure about how to do that. Like, how do you do that? You know, and so, you know, this is something that what I teach and what I encourage them to do is I encourage them to do these things with parents in the room and then encourage them to have parents leave the room so that then they can move it into the confidential care piece and how to address the issues of confidential care. And so, you know, we talk, I talk early on with the parents in the room about sexuality, drugs, alcohol. I call it drugs, sex, and rock and roll. We're going to talk about those kind of questions right now, right? And so it's important to role model for the parents.
I love that, by the way. So good. I'm totally stealing that. So right? Good. So good.
It's important to role model for the parent talking to the team. Like, I think that they need to hear and see us talking to the team, but we need to be educated and prepared for that. And so it's important to help our students become comfortable with that. Then when the parents leave the room, you move into the confidential care piece of, you know, in the state of Pennsylvania, you know, once you turn 13, you are, we're permitted to talk about things confidentially. And if there are things that you want to talk about related to these issues, then if you don't want me to tell your parents, and you're not in danger, by law, I'm not allowed to. But I want you to know that I always try to work with my teens to bring parents in, because the best outcomes occur when parents are involved. So that's kind of how I approach it, you know, with them. And so the confidential care piece is really important for everyone to understand then what are the parameters of, you know, what, when do you have to bring parents in where you have to. And then the question also comes of, well, what if a teen says, well, if there's any possibility you're going to tell my parents, I'm not going to tell you. Okay, well, let's just talk about some other things and we'll kind of come back and revisit that, you know. But it's I've really, truly never had an issue, and many people are uncomfortable with that. You know, it's that whole, in terms of the pronouns and what people want you to call them. I'm actually staying away from the word preferred, because I was told that by someone that saying preferred means that it's not real. It's not the real identity. So the identity is the identity. So I kind of walk into the room and say, you know, hello, my name's Brenda Cassidy. I'm the nurse practitioner here. I use she, her pronouns. It's on my badge, by the way. And certainly pharmacists and allied health professionals should be doing that. You know,
I have a button that I wear that has my pronouns on it. Yes.
An ally button. Right. Yep. So, and then I say, and you can call me Brenda. What would you like me to call you? And what pronouns do you use? And I do all of that with parents in a room, you know. And so, again, it's role modeling for the parents and opening up that area of communication, hoping that when they leave, they're going to continue to have those conversations. So those are just little, you know, things that I think are really important. Also, having that welcoming environment where there's, you know, posters and stickers and rainbow flags, things that give that that nonverbal message that this is a welcoming and a safe environment. As well as, at one point I was so excited to see this, I saw the children's CCP practices, they're the pediatric practices throughout the state, there's probably more than 50 of them. They started posting flyers that say, we provide confidential care to your teens. You know, you can expect to be asked to leave the room one, you know, while we speak with your team. And I forget all the wording and verbiage that was on there, but these were posters that were in a waiting area, in the exam rooms. And that's the other piece, is if you're in a practice and you have multiple providers, there's always been an issue where some providers do it, others don't. You know, kids go to one provider, it happens. They go to another provider, it doesn't. So there should be kind of a protocol and a standardized approach to confidential care.
Yeah, that consistency is really important, especially, you know, when you want them to continue to engage the healthcare system. And so oftentimes I see that it's an access problem because, you know, obviously when we talk about minoritized communities and gender affirmation, you know, it's very difficult for them to find a provider that affirms them. Mm-hmm. And then once they do, and then they go back and maybe that provider's not available, it causes this riff where they're like, oh, should I go back? Should I not go back? Because I don't know. It's like, you know, it's like Russian roulette. Am I going to get that same person, or am I going to feel affirmed? And so instead of going through that stress, they just don't seek care at all.
That's right.
And that's part of the reason why the community has so many issues with health disparities and inequities is because of that access issue around, you know, just not feeling affirmed, not feeling like they're, you know, that the care that they're getting is culturally competent, confidential, right? All of the things. So I really and truly appreciate the work that you're doing, because I think we need to be doing more of it first and foremost. And then also, you know, something else that I wanted to chat with you about is that there's this now active, systematic effort within our states to both criminalize and marginalize our trans youth. So I don't know if you want to speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, there's clear evidence and support in the literature of discrimination, stigma and discrimination with all LGBTQIA individuals, and in particular, our youth. And so this causes exactly what you said. They have negative experiences, they don't come back. And, you know, it's really important that we as providers and healthcare professionals are able to approach it in an open manner to communicating that safe space. And, you know, we're working on across the board related to social justice issues, as well as transgender discrimination, to be able to not necessarily confront, but at least dialogue with our peers who are also providers, who maybe are not aware of some of the things that they're saying and doing that are microaggressions. And so some of the work I have moved into actually is implicit bias. And so it's really, really important for all of us in healthcare to know what our implicit bias is. We have it. Every single one of us walking the face of this earth has bias. And it's based on our cultural background and how we grew up and how we were raised and where we were raised. And so that's a really important first step for all of us to be aware of, because most of the time it's not intentional. It's not like a provider goes into a room and wants to, you know, say the wrong thing or make somebody feel discriminated against. They just are not aware of it. And so I've done some work in that area too, with bias. But dialoguing, I took a seminar here at Pitt, like a 6-7 week seminar last summer, I think it was, on just social justice. I forget what they called it, but we had some big sessions, and then we had some small group discussions. It was so wonderful because there was the ability to dialogue, and, you know, it was obviously a safe place to dialogue and talk about those sorts of things. But I think people were not doing that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think so. You know, obviously I'm a woman of color. I have my fair share of challenges just waking up being myself, you know? So, I mean, so, you know, a lot of times when, you know, working within this community, you know, people are like, well, you know, what can somebody who is cis and, you know, it does not have the same struggles. I'm like, well, I'm also a minoritized you know, population. And so that allyship, I think, is really important, especially when we think about lived experience and looking at things through a trauma-informed lens. And knowing that oftentimes when you come from a minoritized community, you have experienced some form of trauma. Right. And so that needs to be acknowledged and know that there are certain triggers that may impact whether or not somebody actively takes your recommendations or chooses not to, and unfortunately jeopardizes their health. And so, you know, that trauma-informed lens is really important, especially with LGBTQIA plus communities. So
I think it's important, excuse me, you know, there's a lot of providers that are out there that have been practicing for quite some time. And this stuff has really just been surfacing. I keep saying we're late to the party, but we're at least there in healthcare. But, you know, I think many of them want to understand and be aware and do and say the right thing, but they don't know where the resources are. It was something that I found within the School of Nursing. So colleagues and I looked at the LGBTQIA plus health content in our curriculum, and it just was really not there. And going to the literature, found that there were no real guidelines as to what should be there. So we did some focus groups and with faculty, students, LGBTQIA individuals and providers who care for LGBTQIA about what healthcare providers need to know and to be aware of, and developed an online module that actually is copyright approved and freely shareable. I'm excited about and it's just an introductory online module, not just for nursing, but for healthcare providers to just kind of open that door to awareness, terminology, health disparities, and respectful communication were the themes that came out of our focus groups that the content is based on. And then our faculty said, we want to teach this. We don't know where the resources are. And so we developed a resource toolbox that we share with this module so that people have those resources. But there are tons of resources. Fenway Institute, LGBTQIA Health Education, National Health Education Center, tons of resources. And so, you know, in my mind, when I think about all of this, I think about education first, changing clinical practice second, and then being aware of the policy issues and legislation issues that are happening right now. As healthcare providers, we need to be on top of all of that. Not an easy task, but we need to.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for talking about that, being open to change. I know, especially when you're working at a big university system, it's a bit of a challenge to get anything changed within the curriculum. So I applaud you for that. I know that's something that we specifically did at our College of Pharmacy. So I was able to add those objectives within our gender-based health curriculum about 5 years ago. And I think it's really made a difference. And the students, I've had many students come up to me after, and like, first of all, students that had not disclosed that they were part of the community and said that that was like the first time that they really felt seen. And it was so touching. And then I also, several years ago, had a student disclosed to me that they were transmasculine and wanted to ask me about when they should get their bottom surgery done. And they were considering doing it over Christmas break. And I was like, that is not enough time for recovery. So, you know, little things like that, that come up, and I actively talk about it. And the fact that when that conversation happened, I was not knowledgeable, and it made me want to get educated. And so places like Fenway, places like WPATH, places like UCSF Center for Transgender Excellence, yes, those are places that we can all go. And most of these places, it's credit is available. So it's not like you're doing it for nothing. You can get it towards your licensure. Mm-hmm. And most of them are free. Right. So that's a lot of, you know, a lot of this too is because it's grant and federal funded, it's free. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, sexual health is something that we just we don't like to talk about for whatever reason. And I'm like, everyone has it. We just want to make sure that, you know, we're doing things safely and, you know, that there's a fair amount of harm reduction that goes into things because, you know, behavior is very difficult to change. But when you want your patient to open up to you and have that open and honest conversation, it needs to be, sexual health needs to be part of that conversation because so much of our personal lives and, you know, our, you know, issues around intimacy, they all focus around that. And when that part of your life is not going well, mm-hmm. it impacts everything else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. With that being said, I know we don't have too much more time, but I do wanted to just briefly touch on your vaccine advocacy work, especially within the HPV vaccine space.
Yeah. Early on when I went back for my doctorate, HPV vaccine was somewhat new on the scene. And so I focused on that for a number of years, improving HPV vaccine rates. And the girls, obviously, the girls were recommended before the boys. So once, you know, we started getting good results with the girls, then started focusing on the boys. So I've done a number of projects, research projects, and been involved in some initiatives related to the HPV vaccine. You Are Key is a program through the CDC that is a wonderful program to educate providers about how to make that recommendation. And so my first project, I was focused on the parents making their decision and educating them in a way that the literature supported they would make a decision to vaccinate as opposed to hold off. And I started thinking, you know, I don't know that it's the parent. I think like it's the provider. Something's happening in the exam room. And sure enough, the literature and the research started to show the evidence is there that it was the how the recommendation was being made by the provider that impacted hesitancy versus acceptance. And there's a lot of literature supporting that. And so, you know, how a provider would say at 11 years old, you know, okay, so now it's time to get the meningitis and the Tdap vaccine. And if you want the HPV vaccine, he or she can have it now. No, that's not how you say it. You know, so the
no,
UFC,
I'm like,
yeah,
yeah, adolescent yeah. trifecta. Yeah. I tell them these are what is recommended, routine and recommended. And then if they go, oh, I don't want that. I'm like, okay, you want to leave your child unprotected?
Right.
Well,
right.
These are the reasons why I think you should consider getting this vaccine. And remember, like, if you wait, it's pretty expensive. Like, mm-hmm. you know, those kinds of things. But yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to have your child be at risk for cancer? Okay.
Right. Right. And one of the things in the literature that supports acceptance is to say, I got my kids vaccinated against the HPV vaccine as a provider. But I'll tell you, you know, it's still one of the ones that are not required by the school system. And so that is a, you know, a split for parents while just getting the school vaccines. And the number of years ago, I can't remember when it was, but Allegheny County tried to mandate the HPV vaccine for the schools in Allegheny County. And there was the health department held a public forum where people were allowed to come and speak. And I went, and there were lots of gyne OB providers, as well as ENT providers who were seeing, you know, the cancer that is caused by HPV in men and women. Later on, who got up and gave their, you know, stories about how important this is and what can happen, you know, how you can prevent the cancers that they cause. And there were parents that got up and supported it. There were three people there that were anti-vaxxers related particularly to the HPV vaccine. The news covered the story. And I'm sorry to say that instead of showing all of the numerous positive testimony, they focused on the two or three negative testimonies. There was tons of backlash, and the Allegheny County Health Department had to back off.
Wow, that's so unfortunate.
Yes.
Which by the way, I love that you brought that up, because as somebody who actively participates in the media, so one of the things that I was lucky enough to start getting involved with is healthcare media contributing to my local television networks, but I've also done some national interviews. And I think it's really important for us to craft the story, or else the story is going to be crafted for us. And that is a perfect example of when you left it up to the to the media outlet to cover the story, and you didn't have anyone there to comment on it, it ended up being more negative.
So right.
And so if there was, if there was somebody there who was like, hey, let me get on camera and talk about what's going on today and what this is all about, I think they would have been more likely to cover it positively. But I think a lot of times, in general, healthcare providers are like, I just take care of patients. Like, I don't want to be on camera, right? Like, that's not something that's like easily part of our repertoire. And it's definitely not something that we actively are involved in unless we get the opportunity, mm-hmm. Or, you know, or have had media training. And so, yeah, I think that's an excellent point that you brought that up, because, you know, it really is important that we have the best messengers for delivering the message, first and foremost, people who look and sound like the population that it impacts, in addition to making sure that we have providers that are more reflective of the communities that they serve in order to be affirming.
Yep.
Because I always say, like, people say, you know, DEI, right? Diversity, inclusion, and equity. We're never going to have equity unless we have inclusion. And until you have inclusion of diverse communities, you're never going to have diversity. So it's like we say it that way, but really the inclusion, like, if you don't give me a seat at the table, it doesn't go anywhere after that. Mm-hmm. Right. And mm-hmm. as a minority don't see myself in that position, I'm never going to aspire to be that. Brenda, this has been absolutely lovely. Thank you so much for your time and your work and your advocacy. If people want to follow you, find out what you're doing, if they want to, you know, look into the work that you're accomplishing, where can people find you? Where can they connect with you?
Yeah, well, I'm listed on Pitt's website, the School of Nursing Faculty Directory. And so there's a little blip on there about whatever research I'm doing and teaching and those sorts of things. And then my email is on there. And so anybody that is interested in emailing me, I would love to hear from them. And as I said, the learning module that we have and the resource toolbox are freely shareable. So if anybody is interested in those, you know, just reach out to me. And Christina, if you want me to send you links to those, I'm happy to do so.
That would be fantastic. We'd love to include that in the show notes if possible. So thank you so much again for your time and all of the work that you're doing. I hope that our audience continues to, you know, go and find our guests and connect with them. And if this message resonated with you, and if you want to find out more information about confidential care and caring for adolescents, and the LGBTQIA+ community, I encourage you to reach out to Dr. Cassidy. Again, my name is Dr. Christina Madison. I am your host of the podcast. And remember, you can find me at the Public Health Pharmacist at your favorite social media platform, and continue to listen to these episodes. I'm extremely excited to bring these fantastic guests to you. So subscribe, and you can even use your at-home device to say that you want to start your morning with Public Health Matters podcast. These are all the things that you can do to keep yourself educated and on the forefront of all things public health. And with that, remember, public health matters.
Stay safe, be well, and remember, public health matters.